things are becoming to become more interesting and more specific. So select group 5, and we go into gravity. And we begin quantum gravity. And I have decided to first introduce all the main ideas and techniques in 3 dimensions, where the theory is much simpler, because you will see how everything works. And then the 4-dimensional theory, which is the interesting one, has obviously some key additional ingredients and features, but most of the structure is the same, and so it's much easier to do 2 steps. So lecture 5, gravity. And I'm not sure how far I'm going to get today, but I will do 2 things. First, just give some remind you and give some information about classical gravity, the way to formulate it appropriate for the quantization, and then go to the quantum theory. So let's start from classical gravity. Well, you'll know we have a fantastic theory that describes gravity very well, which is general relativity. So what is general relativity? How it works? The formulation that Einstein gave of general relativity, so Einstein formulation, it's not the formulation we're going to use. It's almost the same, but a little bit different from the one we're going to use. It's a formulation where the gravitational field is a symmetric two-index tensor, G mu nu, as you know, which it was prominent in Einstein's mind, can be interpreted as the Riemannian, or better, pseudo-Riemannian metric of space-time. Also, one might even not think about that. Okay, this is about our geometrical picture of what's happening. It's the field. This is the gravitational field, and the dynamics is given by the Einstein equations, which follow from the action S, which is a functional of G mu nu on some region of space-time, which is 1 over 16 pi g, g being a Newton constant, the integral over this region of space-time of the square root of minus g, by which I indicate the determinant of this metric, and then the Ricci scalar computed out of this metric minus a constant, which is called 2 lambda. So this is the action of general relativity from which one gets the Einstein equations, which I'm sure you have seen, which is the Ricci tensor computed out of the second derivative of the field minus 1/2 g mu nu, the Ricci scalar, which is a contraction of a Ricci tensor, plus lambda g mu nu equals 0 if there is no matter, and the stress energy tensor of matter if there is matter. And let me put 0 just because, for simplicity, for the moment, we don't think about matter. We'll think about matter later on. Okay? So this is the theory. Let me stress that in the theory, there are 2 constants. The theory is governed by 2 constants, okay, which are both been measured. One recently, and if you just type them on Google, the present best value are something like 6 × 10⁻⁸ centimeters cube over gram second, and lambda 10 to the minus 35 second minus 2. The reason I'm stressing that is don't be foolished by a lot of current propaganda and money searching, blah, 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 about the great mystery of the cosmological constant, right? This is a theory which works perfectly well at as far as observations are concerned. It doesn't mean it's the final theory of the world, of course, obviously. It doesn't mean we're not going to change it for experimental reasons or even for theoretical reasons. But this theory describes everything we see on large scale, small scale, on the Mercury, black holes, gravitational waves produced by binary systems with spectacular accuracy, up to the dark matter phenomenology, which might be a gravitational phenomenon, so might indicate that there's something to change here, or might not, we don't know. When one brings quantum theory in, all sorts of problems, of course. First, we don't have a quantum theory of the gravitational field itself. That's what we're going to discuss in this class. Second, if we freeze the gravitational field, some configuration, and we want to do the quantum field theory of matter, then we have to do the quantum field theory generically in a curved spacetime, which is far from obvious. Okay. It can be done. If you do it, there's no problem about infinite vacuum energy producing a Planck scale value of the gravitational constant, as people do doing quantum field theory in curved space-time know very well. If you forget even that, and you just do quantum field theory on flat space-time, and so you expand over a Minkowski metric, which is obviously wrong because on the large scale, the Minkowski metric is not a good description of the universe because it's a cosmological constant, in fact. So on the large scale, it's sort of De Sitter or something like that. But if you do that, then standard quantum field theory on flat space-time requires a subtraction of vacuum energy, requires a non-logarithmic, a polynomial renormalization of the vacuum energy, which if you want to interpret it, and if you do it, you do a mistake, as a real energy, it would contribute to an extra term here, giving a huge contribution to lambda. And that's what people call the mystery of the dark energy. Okay? So the mystery of dark energy is that if you do something wrong, if you take three approximations and you do something wrong, you get something wrong. Which is mystery, perhaps, but maybe not. Okay? Which doesn't mean that we have everything clear. We don't have clear how to do quantum gravity. We don't have completely under control, as many people don't have completely under control how to do quantum field theory on curved space-time. Okay? And after all, we don't understand, even in quantum field theory on flat space-time, we don't yet have a physical total understanding of renormalization theory, right? So this is the theory we're considering. The cosmological constant is there. I will go back to the cosmological constant later in this course. I hope to have time to get there. I will drop it whenever it's not needed, it's not playing a role. So I will go to simplify the theory without this term and without this term whenever it's simpler for whenever it's not this is not important. Okay. So this is the Einstein formulation. Now, this cannot be the correct formulation with all due respect for the great man, cannot be the correct formulations, the correct description of the gravitational field for a very simple reason. In the world, there are fermions. Okay? There are electrons, and that's why we can have a wires with light. So fermions are very well described by the Dirac equation. So there should be a way to write this Dirac equation in interaction with the gravitational field. Einstein gave us a fantastic general way of having understanding what is the interaction between a field with any kind of matter and the gravitational field, which is just to go to arbitrary coordinates and take the general covariant form of the equation and then reinterpret it as the equation on curved space-time. Oh well, it doesn't work for the Dirac equation. There's no easy, in fact, there's no general covariant form of the Dirac equation. So we're lost. So either there are no fermions in the world, which is sort of hard, we have to start again to write old physics, or there's something wrong here. Okay? But in fact, there is something wrong here, and it's extremely easy to redo this in a slightly different language, which is perfectly compatible with fermions, and that's tetrad gravity. So because of the presence of fermions, we are forced to use a different formulation of general relativity. It's very, very similar to Einstein. It's not really changing anything. But where the gravitational field is not described by the metric, but is described by a different tensor, a different field, which is a tetrad. And the tetrad has one downstairs space-time index, mu. So for me, mu will always be tangent indices in the manifold, the transformers coordinates, and one flat Minkowski index. I'll say in a moment what this means. All the same range. So what does it mean? It means that the G mu nu is given in terms of this tetrad. So I use this field instead of this field, and this is going to be a function of that field by G mu nu of x is equal E mu I of x, E mu j of x, eta ij, eta being the Minkowski metric. In whatever signature you want, I'm going to mostly be using minus plus plus plus. Okay, so then you can write an action, which is exactly this action here, where every time you see g mu nu, you write these quadratic things in E. Okay, and it turns out that the equation that you get are essentially the same for g mu nu, are the same for g mu nu. And what you gain is that now, in terms of the tetrad, there is a covariant version of this equation here, which is obtained by putting a general a space-time index here, mu, and squeezing here EI mu, which is the tensor given by the matrix inverse to the matrix mu I, okay? And by replacing D with a covariant derivative. I'm not going into the Dirac equation, the definition of the Dirac equation in the curved space-time. That's not particularly important. What is important is that it doesn't exist, the Dirac equation, unless you have the tetrad. Okay, so the tetrad field is required to describe the gravity. If you want, fermions don't live just in a Riemannian manifold. They need a little bit of structure. They need a spin manifold. So they need a tangent space where we need a tangent space to be related to a Minkowski space, so fermions can be defined. So this thing here can be defined. Okay, so this is the tetrad. Now, as soon as you have the tetrad, in this tetrad formulation. You see, if you take the tetrad and you make a Lorentz transformation in the I indices, so you change it to lambda ij of x, where this is a Lorentz transformation in each point, local Lorentz transformation. Ej nu. Obviously, the metric does not change because the Lorentz transformation just hits the Minkowski metric, which is invariant in the Lorentz transformation. So therefore, the entire formulation has a local Lorentz, namely SO31, gauge invariance. Which will leave avec. And in fact, we'll leave with. Sorry, I have some French. In fact, will be a main tool. We use it heavily. And you know, in Young-Mills theory, the Lorentz gauge invariance is not a burden. It's an incredible tool. You can do a lot of stuff just because you have Lorentz invariance. So in principle, you could do physics in a totally gauge invariant manners, but it wouldn't be easier. It would be more complicated. So let's use it, this SO31 gauge invariance, which, by the way, has a geometrical interpretation, which is very simple. So what is a geometrical interpretation of tetrad and this Lorentz invariance here? Well, it's much easier if instead of thinking about the field, you think about the inverse of the field, the one I use for the Dirac equation. So consider the matrix E I mu of x, so which is defined as the matrix which is inverse to the tetrad field. Okay, this is what? This has an upstairs space index, so it's a vector, and there are four of them. So these are four vectors per space point. So these are four vector fields. So the gravitational field can be described by four vector fields going around. And take a point and draw these four vectors, 1, 2, 3, and 4, in space-time. So we're in four dimensions, four vectors. And then you see immediately that they are orthogonal and length 1. Because if you take one and another one, and you make the scalar product, by this I mean EI, EJ, mu, nu, G, mu, nu. So in the Riemannian manifold, you have this fields. And with the Riemannian metric, you compute the angle between the two and the length of each one of the two, the angle between I and J were the difference and the length were the same. Then, of course, by just from this equation here, by just turning things around, you see that this is the Minkowski metric, EIJ. Which means that any two different ones are orthogonal, zero, and each one is long one. So in other words, if you have a Riemannian manifold, this tetrad field, which satisfies this equation, are tetrad fields such that everywhere they are an orthogonal, they give an orthogonal frame. Okay? If you don't have a Riemannian manifold, just have these four vectors around, they define a Riemannian manifold. Because they define a frame which by definition is orthogonal, autonormal, right? So I can define a Riemannian manifold by instead of giving the distance between two points, what does it mean that this is a geometrical interpretation? It means that, go back. It means that in space-time, given any two points, there is a distance, ds, such that ds squared is g mu nu dx nu dx nu. So this is a manner in which this field defines distance between any two points. Instead of giving this distance, you can give these four vector fields, and in every point x, declare these four vector fields to be orthogonal. Okay, so to define length and angles themselves. Okay, like you do in usual Minkowski coordinates, right? You write your Minkowski coordinates, and you say that these are length and these are angles. So this is a geometrical interpretation of the tetrad. And then the geometrical interpretation of the Lorentz gauge invariance is obvious, because if you take this and rotate with a Lorentz transformation, you're obviously defining the same Minkowski metric. So in any point, You can take your frame and you rotate it arbitrarily with a Lorentz transformation, or precisely rotate three dimension and Lorentz boost the time coordinate. And this is the interpretation of the Lorentz invariance. Now, as soon as you have a gauge invariance, if you have studied Young-Mills, you think, well, if there's a gauge invariance, it's natural to write a connection in this field. So is there a Lorentz connection sort of naturally defined in this game? Let me not use A as is usual in gauge fields, but use omega as is used in gravity. So is there in the game a Lorentz connection? So it's going to be in the Lorentz algebra. So Lorentz algebra is the antisymmetric here, right? It's minus omega mu ji. Is there one naturally defined here? Yes, because if you have E, you can define an omega such that the covariant derivative of E is zero in some precise sense. So let me do it nicely, properly. To do it properly, it is better to, let me put this aside in a moment, it's better to use form notation, differential form notation. You could view it just as a way of writing things easily. So you have some, I guess you've seen differential forms, have you? Okay. So instead of writing this field there, I write four differential forms. So I is 1 to 0 to 3, defined by EI mu dx mu. Okay. And then I have the standard machinery. In particular, I have the D operator, the differential operators in differential form notation. Okay, once I have that, this I can write as omega ij, just omega ij mu dx mu. Okay. And the equation that define omega given E is the following, is E I plus omega I j wedge E j equals zero. In other words, if you take an arbitrary E and an arbitrary omega, you compute that, you don't get zero. You get something which is called the torsion. If this is zero, then it can be proved. It's not completely obvious. It's a little bit of algebra. But in fact, it's true that this is a unique solution for omega given E. So there's always solution. There's only one. And the solution is called the spin connection determined by E, or torsionless, or even metric sometime, whatever. Now this it's very nice because in fact it allows you to use a standard Young-Mills way of thinking. You can define a curvature of that connection. Every time you have a connection, you define a curvature, right? You go around. So this is d omega ij plus omega omega ij kk. And it is just an exercise to show that this is nothing else than the Riemann curvature when omega is the omega determined by E with some indices contracted with E. So in other words, this can be proven from the equation I wrote down. This is related to the Riemann tensor, which of course has a completely different index structure, mu, nu, rho, sigma. And the relation is that R mu nu rho sigma, let me write all the indices. All right, the component, this is a two form. So Fij rho sigma. So this is antisymmetric here, things too much. And mu is just I with an E mu I. And nu is just J with an E mu J. Internal indices are raised with Minkowski matrix. Spacetime indices are raised with Gmu. Okay, so this is the relation between the curvature of the spin connection and the Riemann tensor. It's just stupid, boring formalism, but it's much easier to do gravity with this language than the other one. Now, if you use that and you write the Ricci scalar, the Ricci scalar you just have to contract with some other E there, it's pretty immediate to show that the action up there, I just use notation units in which 8 pi, in which 8 pi g is 1 to simplify, so I don't want to bring the g with me. It's going to be by E, wedge f by j k l, epsilon I j k l, where f is the f computed by omega, which is omega determined by E. So this is an action which depends on E. And this gives the Einstein equations. Okay, so we're still doing gravity, still doing the Einstein equation. We have changed a little bit the notation. Now, one more step, another formulation, which is enormously simplify things, and you'll see why in a moment. This step was something Palatini, something found by somebody called Palatini, who realizes, in fact, not in this formulation, in the metric formulation, he realizes that in the metric formulation, you can take the Christoffel symbols as independent variables, and the theory works the same. So let's do it here. Suppose I write an action which depend on two fields, E and omega, now independent, so that they don't necessarily satisfy that equation there. So you have A Lorentz connection and A tetrad, and you write a functional of both defined as E, wedge E. Let me use some notation for the epsilon. This is a completely antisymmetric object. Let me just declare to, I can write this as E, wedge F star. A star mean the I'm dualizing within these indices and I'm contracting. So this is just notation for that. So suppose I write E, wedge F star of omega. So this is just depend on E and this just depend on omega. Okay? And I compute the equation of motion. And then there's a little bit of magic. One wouldn't believe it unless one does it. But what happens is that you have the equation of motion for E and the equation of motion for omega. So when you vary omega, you get some equation of motion. When you vary E, you get some equation of motion. Well, what do you get if you vary omega? You see, here you have d omega plus the thing that makes it gauge invariant. So when you vary it, d goes on this side. You have sort of dE plus the thing that makes it gauge invariant. So you get a gauge invariant equation for dE. What else could it be if not that one? In fact, if you do properly, what you find is that equation there. So the equation of motion of this action when you vary omega is that one, which is the same as saying that omega is d omega determined by E. Okay? And then when you vary E, you get something which using that is just the Einstein equations. So in other words, this is again generativity. It's just standard generativity written in terms of two fields, a tetrad field and a connection field. And look how beautiful it is. It's polynomial, right? This is EE. This is d omega plus omega omega. It's a simple, super simple polynomial action for two fields instead of that horrible mess that Einstein and Riemann and Ricci and Levi-Civita and his friends wrote down with all sorts of super complicated inversion. And you remember the formulas for the spin connection for the Christoffel symbols, which has the inverse of the G, all sorts of horrors, right? So all sorts of horrors is not needed, in fact, to do. Yes?
How general is it? So, like, to write some another action in terms of E and omega? will be equivalent if we were like with respect to E and omega is independent, or like we treat them as
I don't know a general theorem about that. It sort of, for reasons I have not understood, it always works when you do pure gravity. It is not true in general. It's definitely not true in general. For instance, if you add here the action for the fermion field, psi bar deep psi, then you have two actions, one in which you consider E and omega independent, and one in which you just see everything as a function of E. They're not equivalent. They're two different theories. In one theory, there is a four fermion interaction, which is not present in the other one. But generally different. Of course, you can then add a piece of one that looks like the other one, but it's a. So, in general, it's not always true that if you take a theory written in a sort of second order formulation, you rewrite it in first order formulation, you get something equivalent. But for gravity, it's true with Palatini. The metric variables is true in this formula here, is true for other similar things that come out in analogous variation. Okay, last step. Question, what if I don't, since this is polynomial, yes. That's right.
So, can we then test which one's correct?
In principle, yes. In principle, yes. In practice.
Do you have any theoretical reason for choosing one or the other?
No.
When we include that topic?
No. No. No.
So, we could be basing it off formalism that isn't true. Because it depends on whether or not we have fermions.
If you add fermions, this. So, S of E being. E wedge F star of omega of E, okay, plus what's the fermion thing? Psi bar D slash psi. So this is a one form. Wedge E. I think this is it. And this is D, which depend on omega, which depend on E. Okay? And the same E omega, where this is E wedge F star of omega plus psi bar gamma. So there's an E here. Gamma E D slash of omega, like E wedge epsilon. So these are not equivalent. Okay. If you compute the equation of motion, they are generally different. However, this is equal. The difference between the two is just an interaction term psi for fermion thing. So this is measurable in principle. It's just four fermion. It's like form of fermions interaction. So suppose you measure it, okay? You say suppose you don't measure it, okay? You say okay, I don't measure it, so this is the right one. No, because you just put a minus here, and you can do first order formalism. Okay. So yes, in fact, I've written a paper some time ago. In some related constants, say, look, one can measure in principle which one's the right one. And somebody immediately wrote a paper saying, well, not really, because if you. In other words, the minimally coupled theories are different. But in both formalism, you can write non-minimally coupled theories, which are equivalent. So you can always write any minimally coupled one as a non-minimally coupled the other one. Okay, last piece, and then we go to quantum. This is nicely polynomial, right? So one is strongly tempted to say, wait a moment, it's like standard scalar fields, so you have nil fields. There are many things one can do. In fact, if I just want to use a form formulas that want to remain polynomial, basically this is it. I mean, I need to write something gauge invariant, it's F, it's two form, I need another two form, EE. Well, there's something else that I can do. I can don't put this star. So I can write E wedge E wedge F with the indices just IJ IJ. So there is another theory of gravity here. Well, what is it? So let's suppose we write this theory. What do we get? Well, if we vary D, if we vary omega, if we vary omega, we get the same equation as before. So then this is just something scalar out of the Riemann curvature. But there's nothing scalar out of the Riemann curvature except the Ricci tensor. So what do we get? Well, we get the same thing as before up to an epsilon. So in fact, if you do the calculation, you will not be surprised. You get R mu nu rho sigma epsilon mu nu rho sigma, zero, because of the symmetry properties of R. Okay? So in fact, this, this object here has no effect on the equation of motion, is zero, as far as omega is omega of E. But if I have E and omega independently, this term here does not affect the equation of motion, but it's a different action. I could add it to the action. So it might give a different quantum theory. Right? In QCD, you can add you can write the Young-Mills action in the form F wedge F star. It's the standard way of writing the Young-Mills action. And you can always add here plus something which is called usually theta QCD, F wedge F. This has no effect on the Young-Mills equation, like that one. But this is measurable in principle and affect the quantum theory. So let's not discard this term, and let's couple it to the theory. And let's write, and that would be my final action, something which is called the Holst action, because Holst was the second to discover it. As usual, you know, things are named from the second person who discovered something, which is the following, is an action function of the tetrad, a spin connection, which is the one I just wrote down, EE F star, plus a constant which for historical reason is called 1 over gamma, E wedge E wedge F, where by this I mean the index is contracted this way, without an epsilon. So this is the action with which we're going to do four-dimensional quantum gravity. Sort of the most natural, most generic action for a tetrad spin connection, which is polynomial, which has the right symmetries, which is SL, which is Lorentz invariant, generic covariant. Gamma has no effect on the classical theory. Any. But let's keep it there because it may play a role in the quantum theory. And now to go back to your question, if I couple a fermion minimally this way, then I get an interaction like that with gamma in front of it. So I can say, gamma is measurable. Okay? But then I could take minus 1 of gamma away. And so I could equally well say, well, I can just add a constant here with an interaction, and it would be the same thing. So the measurability of gamma one can depend how one present the thing, exactly as before. So here's the picture. This is standard general relativity. It gives the standard Einstein equations. It's much better because it can be coupled to fermions. It's polynomial, and it looks very much like ML theory, and historically is the one that was good for doing loop quantum gravity. And this closes the classical part. So what I'm going to do now, and I'll start introducing it, is move toward the quantum theory. And as I said, I will do it in three dimensions first. So let me do it immediately, the introduction of the three dimensions. So I'll do the analog in 3D, Euclidean. So there will be not be Lorentz, but there will be a group that is much easier and more familiar, which is a rotation group. And my field is going to be a triad . So three vectors, okay? Three vectors which define orthonormality, orthogonality at length in three dimensions. I will write this as E, A little I of x, where A is 1, 2, 3, and I is also 1, 2, 3. But these indices are tangent indices, are going to be raised by the metric, and these indices are SO3 indices, so are going to raise with delta ij. Okay, the standard flat indices. And there is a spin connection, omega aij, antisymmetric in ij, which is in the algebra of SO3. So it's a rotations, generator of rotation of SO3. And in fact, this is antisymmetric. And it's convenient often to write it as epsilon ijk omega k a. So every time you have a vector in three dimensions with two indices, you can trade it with a vector with one index, right? Because it's antisymmetric, three components. It's like the magnetic field in three dimensions. We view it as a vector, but it's really an object with two vectors. It's a polar vector. And the action of generativity in three dimension is the sister of that one, is just EI wedge FI, where FI is D omega I plus epsilon IJ K omega J omega k. These are also the structure constants of SO3. So this is the action in 3D. There is no complication of other terms. There is no complication of Hall's action. This is what. And the local gauge invariant is an SO3 gauge invariant, of course. So this is a local SO3 gauge invariant. So now we take this theory. This is our theory, two fields, and we want to write a quantum theory. Okay. So writing a quantum theory means writing a quantum theory. What do we want? We want basically two things. We want the Hilbert space of the theory, the operators, and the transition functions. Okay. Careful. Remember the Hilbert space, the two Hilbert spaces. Remember the story of quantum mechanics without time. There is an extended Hilbert space, and then there is the one that solves the dynamics, sort of the one projected down which solved the Willer-Witt equation. So. We're going to write the Hilbert space, the extended one, And some operators that correspond to that field, which correspond to the partial observables. These fields are the partial observables. And then we're going to write the transition amplitude. Okay, and how do we do that? Well, we're going to do like I mentioned in the first, we're going to write the transition amplitude of Feynman as a limit of a multiple integral. Okay? So we're going to chop not time, but space-time, and then think about the appropriate limit. So we first have to discretize the theory, write the quantum theory of the discretized theory, and then study what happened when we refine the discretization. Quantize discrete theory. Study convergence when you remove when we remove the discretization. Let's plot. So the first thing to do is to discretize the theory. Okay. And remember, in when we were thinking of theories in time, discretize means just breaking this time interval. But remember the example with the parametrized theory, then the time interval themselves will become one of the variables, right, in a general covariance theory. But keep this in mind as an example. So here, what we have to discretize, so we are doing the discretization. What we have to discretize is space-time. It's three-dimensional space-time. So we have to chop it into pieces, like here. And we're going to do it in the most covariant way possible, so not with a cubic lattice like is done in QCD, because cubic requires a notion of straight angles. I mean, here we don't have a background gravitational field. So we're going to chop this by writing, by breaking it in elementary pieces, which are tetrahedra. If we were in two dimensions, if we were in 2D, the natural discretization is in terms of triangles. In three dimensions, you chop space in tetrahedra. So you take your space, you make a lot of tetrahedra around, and this will be the structure of the discretized theory that we will use. Now, a little bit of terminology. Let me do it here. I introduce it now. We're going to use it heavily in the future. So it's the end of the class. I will repeat it next time. So we have a tetrahedron. And a lot of tetrahedra attached to one another that do the discretization. And this is called a triangulation. And the choice of one triangulation, I call it delta. So a triangulation is made by tetrahedra, which are these things here. And each tetrahedra has triangles, which are the triangles, of course, which has sides, which are called bones in when triangulation, so each one of these lines. And then there are the points of the triangulation. Now, it turns out that when you want to discretize a general covariance theory, so the problem is to put this, to replace these continuous fields with discrete fields that live there, is much easier, and it works much better if you use the dual triangulation, the dual of the triangulation, which is sometimes called delta star. What is the dual of the triangulation? Is something that you obtain if you take a, you put a point. Let me do it in two dimensions first. It's much easier. So this is a triangulation in two dimension. This is a dual of the triangulation in two dimension. Okay? The picture says all. So in three dimension, what happens? You put a point inside each tetrahedron. So inside each one of these, you put a point that you call vertex. Point. And then anytime you have two tetrahedra that touch one another through one one triangle, you put a edge, a line that connects the two, like in this picture here. So dual to each tetrahedron, there's a vertex. Dual to each triangle, there is something called edge. And each vertex has four edges, of course, because the tetrahedron has four faces, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? And we're not done yet in three dimensions. In two dimensions, we would be done. But in three dimensions, we're not done yet. Because you see, dual to each bone here, you can go around, you can exit this way, and you can follow all the edges that go around this bone here. So you get a face. And each edge has three faces, one per each side of the triangle. So each edge here has one face, two face, three faces. Okay, you see it? There's a vertex here, a vertex here. And this is all we need for doing the discretization. A set of vertices, edges, and faces is called a two complex. And we'll need the notion of two complex heavily. The theory of quantum gravity is defined on two complexes. So what is a two complex? Is a set of edge of vertices, edges, and faces with some boundary relation between them. Each edge is bounded by two vertices. Each face is bounded by an arbitrary number here of edges, and each edge here bounds three faces. Okay. So what's a dual picture of that thing there? Let me try to draw it, and then I'm gonna get to the end. So I have a vertex, which is a tetrahedron. I have four four edges that stick out, which are the four faces of this tetrahedron. And then I have six faces, each for each couple of these. So let me draw them. One is this one. One is this one. This one. One is this one. This one. One is this one. You see the picture? Not great. So this is dual to a tetrahedron, right? You can put a tetrahedron here with one vertex inside here, one vertex there, and each face is dual to one of these bones. And its edge is dual to one of the faces. Get used to that, because otherwise you'll get lost forever. Okay? So don't confuse vertex, edge, face, which is a two complex, with tetrahedra, triangles, bones, which is in the triangulation. These quantities here will be the same in four dimensions. We're gonna use them. And the basic formula that defines loop quantum gravity is constructed in terms of these things here. All right. So now what remains to do is to take these two fields, E and omega, and replace it with discrete variables, like we did in the classical theory when I replaced QT with just QN. The discretization is what Feynman did. We're going to replace the continuous E field with some discrete thing and omega with some discrete thing. It turns out, after this is a game which has been played over and over again, but the cleanest and nicest way, which gives an immediate, very simple discretization, is to use edges to discretize the spin connection. If you think for a moment, that's exactly what happens in QCD. In QCD, I don't know if you've done QCD on a lattice, though most of you said no in the question I asked you. When you discretize QCD, you use group variables attached to the edges of a triangulation. So we're going to put group variables here, which are the exponentiation of the connection along this line here. And we're going to, the E field, we're going to integrate it on the bounds. Okay? So let me just write it explicitly, what it is. So instead of the continuous E field, we'll write one E variable for each bond, but a bond corresponds to a face. So I put a face here, which is going to be the line integral of the one-form E on the corresponding bond dual to the face. And E is a one-form, has an index I, so is an element of R3. So you have this E field, you have this triangulation, you have this tetrad field, right? You have three vectors here. And you look at the form thing, and you integrate the form around this thing here. What you get is enormously simple, because if you think for a moment that you can always locally, this is generativity, you can always locally imagine that you're in flat coordinates. So in flat coordinates, you can always get coordinates where EAI of X is delta DAI. These are things to be so small. So you're just integrating delta on this line here. So in other words, in locally Minkowskian coordinates, you associate to its bone a vector which is just a bone in coordinates, right? So nothing very fancy. So to each bone or face, you associate a vector which is the vector in locally Minkowskian coordinates. And in particular, the length of the bone is going to be EFI vector modulus. And the connection, and then I close, the connection, you associate a group element, U, which is and I'll stop here. It's the connection is in the algebra, so you can integrate it to get a group element, and you integrate it along one of the edges. In other words, you move from here to here, you have a connection, you can integrate the algebra element, and you get a group element associated to the edge. So now you have I'll repeat that next time if you're tired, is the end of the. Now you have a theory which is just one vector for each face, one group element for each edge, and it turns out to be that the action can be approximated in an extremely simple way in terms of these objects here, in such a way that if the triangulation is sufficiently refined, it converges to the action there. This will happen, I'll do it a little bit more carefully tomorrow. So I went a little bit fast at the end, I'll repeat it tomorrow morning. You have questions? Yes.
Not connected to each other, so flattening you like. Is that some kind of topological term?
Yes, it's can be thought as a topological term. That's right.
Okay, what topology does it measure? What does it tell me about a manifold?
About the four-dimensional manifold? It has a name. It's known by mathematicians. So I'll give you the name the next time. It tells you something about the SL2C bundle in which you are over spacetime. Okay. Because there is an SL2C connection there, and the tangent. Space, which is glued to it by E. It's called, I forgot. I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's a it's a bit tricky because to be precise, you can integrate by parts, and what. So you get one boundary terms and one topological invariant.
So again, a question regarding this action, the term that's zero. Does it mean that in the quantum theory, if we would write it in terms of the R mu nu rho sigma, that the Riemann is not going to have the symmetries it has in the classical action? As in, is this action always going to be zero?
I never thought it this way, but no, because this equation here is only true if that equation is satisfied. Mm-hmm. So off shell, where that equation is not satisfied, okay. The Riemann tensor, which you can still compute because it's just a function of E, has its own symmetries. But F, contrasted with its indices, is not any more equal to the Riemann. And therefore, that's not zero. So what this is here is F contracted to some E's, contracted to epsilon.
But still on the solutions to the
equation. Oh, yeah. On the solution of the equation of motion, that equation is satisfied. This is equal to that. And on the solution of equation of motion, this is zero. In the quantum theory, this will still be zero on shell. But if you think about the Feynman formulation, you're integrating over fields which are not solution of equation of motion. So the question is over which other fields are you integrating? Okay? So you're integrating in the Feynman path integral over configurations which do not satisfy that equation there. And therefore, we're... this term here might be not zero. And so this affects the quantum theory because it affects the quantum fluctuations, not on shell, but off shell.
So if you can't relate it to the Riemann tensor anymore off shell, what is it then?
Sorry?
If you can't relate it to the Riemann tensor anymore, if it's off shell, then what is it?
It's this.
I mean, geometrically.
Oh, geometrically. If that equation is not satisfied, the geometry you're dealing with, this is not a Riemannian geometry. You have extra stuff. Okay, so it's not something which has any meaning in terms of Riemannian geometry at all. It has only meaning in terms of a richer geometry, where the spin connection and the tetrad are not. So. If the right hand side of that thing is a torsion, and this can be rewritten as some term in terms of the torsion, I think it's a quadratic term of the torsion. So geometrically, it's something called torsion. I don't know if you have studied it. This is how you can think about it. Louis is pretending to have the room, so. I guess we have to go. Tomorrow morning, come if you have more questions. Tomorrow morning, first thing, I'll take questions, and I will repeat this discretization because it's the master of discretizing generativity is sitting down, but he doesn't use this formulation here. See you tomorrow.